Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to update some information concerning biological warfare, and in particular, the art of genetic engineering, or the science of genetic engineering, as it applies to biological warfare. This is a subject that I've dealt with at considerable length in numerous broadcasts that are available from Spitfire, including and especially RFA-16, AIDS, Epidemic or Weapon of War, dealing with the almost certainty at this point that AIDS is not a naturally occurring disease, but rather is iatrogenic or man-made, and in all likelihood, the deliberate application of genetic engineering to biological warfare. That same subject crops up in numerous other broadcasts, including broadcasts involving interviews with Ed Haslam, the author of the vitally important recent book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. Also, interviews with Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the author of the vitally important recent book, Emerging Viruses, that we're going to be dealing with again this evening, or today, I should say. And interviews involving Ed Haslam and Len Horowitz and Dr. Alan Cantwell, and also Dr. Garth Nicholson, who, along with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson, has developed very compelling evidence that some of the Gulf War syndrome, in fact, can be attributed to a genetically engineered microorganism called a mycoplasma, which had a gene from HIV inserted into it to make it more pathogenic. For listeners who find the discussion that's about to follow somewhat impenetrable or improbable, and I can appreciate that, I strongly encourage them to get a hold of some of those broadcasts available from Spitfire, which, time permitting, I will give the address, etc., for later on in the program. A very scary, though to veteran listeners not at all surprising, article appeared in the Financial Times of London of Friday, January 22nd of 1999. This is an article by David Buchan, or Buchan, B-U-C-H-A-N. It's headlined, Alarm at Ethnic Cleansing Weapons. The article reads, advances in genetic engineering could make it possible for weapons targeted at specific ethnic groups to be developed within 10 years, the British Medical Association warned yesterday. The possibility of such, quote, ethnic cleansing, unquote, weapons is raised in a study published yesterday by the BMA, which calls for tightening of provisions of the 1972 International Conventions Against Biological Warfare. The British Foreign Office yesterday said UK government scientists shared the BMA's concerns. The BMA said, quote, although genetic weapons which target a particular ethnic group are not currently a practical possibility, genetic differences between groups do exist, and as the Human Genome Project advances, these differences can be increasingly identified, unquote. This international project aims to map the entire human genetic blueprint by early next century for life-saving research purposes. And I believe that that last quote, the last few words belongs in quotes, that is an opinion. Continuing, the BMA stressed that biological warfare research could be very hard to distinguish from legitimate study. By the way, that same point made in a pair of half-hour segments entitled Uncle Sam and the Swastika Redux, dealing with some of the overlap between some of the companies that helped to finance Adolf Hitler in the pre-World War II and World War II periods, and some of the companies that are being sued by Gulf War veterans for having equipped Saddam Hussein with his biological and chemical warfare capabilities. Now again, this article from the Financial Times of London of Friday, January 22nd of 1999, is significant in a number of ways. First of all, although the possibility of ethno-specific genetically engineered biological warfare weapons is not a new concept, the South African and Israeli governments have been known to have been working on those, among others. The United States government has long been researching the genetic differences between various groups in conjunction with biological and chemical warfare. When an organization as prestigious and as conservative methodologically as the British Medical Association warns that such weapons could be a reality within 10 years, this is something that is not to be taken lightly and that people should pay very, very close attention to. Again, this morning from the British Medical Association, very prestigious, and from a methodological standpoint, very conservative. And a few days later, another very, very important article appeared in that very same paper, namely the Financial Times of London. This article was the lead article on page one. This is from the Financial Times of London of Monday, January 25th of 1999. This is an article by Cleve Cookson, C-O-O-K-S-O-N, writing from Anaheim, California. And it's headlined, Scientists Ready to Create Life from Scratch. And this article reads in part as follows. Scientists in the U.S. say they are ready to create life from scratch in a laboratory. A project to create a bacterial cell from inanimate chemicals for the first time will go ahead as soon as it is passed by an ethics committee. Craig Venter, V-E-N-T-E-R, a pioneer of gene discovery, said molecular biology and genetics had advanced enough to take what would be a momentous step. Quote, "My assumption is that it will be possible to construct a totally man-made organism, but we will not know until we try," unquote, said Dr. Venter, who last year moved from the Institute for Genome Research to set up Celera, C-E-L-E-R-A, a large gene sequencing company. Quote, "We have not decided to go ahead with the experiment yet because we want to give the ethics a chance to catch up," unquote, he said at the American Association for the Advancement of Science annual meeting. Again quoting, "Will we be setting off down a slippery slope that could have negative consequences?" Unquote. The Bioethics Center at the University of Pennsylvania is reviewing the idea. The assessment will cover all foreseeable objections, including the threat that bioterrorists might make use of the technology to create artificial germs. And again, I don't think that's in any way an idle fear, and I think we should pay close attention to that. Skipping down in the article, the scientists will first try to create the simplest possible cell with the minimum number of genes required to sustain life. Many details of the synthesis have yet to be worked out, but the project is likely to be very difficult and take several years to complete. I wonder to what extent perhaps ours or some other country's national security establishment has already undertaken such research. That is not a possibility that I think is to be taken lightly, and one that, on the contrary, I think is to be taken very, very seriously indeed. Something that is altogether terrifying is to contemplate a marriage of the subject material of these two particular articles. If one takes the article from the Financial Times of 1/22/99 about the British Medical Association's expressing alarm at the creation of genetically engineered ethnic cleansing weapons, something which could be spread throughout a population and only kill certain groups, if one marries that subject material with the subject material of this article about scientists preparing to create life from scratch, one could come up with some truly nightmarish scenarios, and ones which are altogether likely to either take place or ones which perhaps could be taking place someplace right now. Again, a very scary thought and one that is not to be taken lightly. Another significant article appeared in the San Jose Mercury News of Tuesday, February 2nd of 1999. In the Science and Technology section on page 1, we find the following. Plan targets threat of biological warfare. Itemizing all the genes in potential biological weapons such as anthrax or bubonic plague could prevent extremists from ever using them against the United States, experts said, calling for a kind of bioterrorism genome project. The project would be similar to the Human Genome Project currently underway, in which scientists are racing to map out or sequence every gene in the human body. Having that information about pathogens at hand could help in the design of quick tests to detect an attack and in the development of drugs to treat or vaccines to prevent infection, they told a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. One also wonders to what extent that could also be used to create those very types of weapons. One of the things that's worth noting with regard to biological warfare research is that the distinction between offensive and defensive biological warfare research is essentially an arbitrary and academic distinction. If you're discovering, if you're researching, I should say, how microorganisms infect and make sick living beings or living tissues, there is essentially no difference between, quote, offensive and, quote, defensive research. It's essentially the same research. The only distinction comes in the application. That's one of the reasons why the January 22, 1999 article from the Financial Times, which warns that, again, quoting, the BMA stressed that biological warfare research could be very hard to distinguish from legitimate study. It's a very important point and one that is very, very well taken. In a number of broadcasts, as already discussed, including an especially RFA 16 entitled AIDS epidemic or war epidemic or weapon of war. I've taken up the subject of AIDS as a genetically engineered virus, and specifically one which is intended to exterminate certain groups and also has very strong psychological warfare capabilities. There is a very strong body of evidence at this point that AIDS was deliberately created by the fascist element within our own and the German national security establishments. This is not to imply that all or even most necessarily of our national security establishment is fascist, but there are some prevailing elements, very strong elements within it that are, and the evidence that those elements, note my use of the term elements, in conjunction with elements of the German national security establishment appear to have been instrumental in the development of AIDS, and indeed the research leading to the development of AIDS appears to have grown out of some of the Third Reich's ethno-specific research, genetic and biological research, that was conducted in, among other places, the concentration camps. At the end of the Second World War, the United States incorporated Erich Traub, the Third Reich's chief of bacteriological and virological warfare, along with his top assistant, Anna Burger, and they were brought into the United States to continue their research, where they continued, which they continued to do, and some of the programs in which they were employed are programs that overlap the research that ultimately appears to have given rise to AIDS. And again, numerous programs involving interviews with Ed Haslam, author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, Dr. Alan Cantwell, the author of, among other titles, AIDS and the Doctors of Death, Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the author of Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, RFA 16, a pair of half-hour segments entitled Still More Fun with Science, and in particular, a three-hour program in which I interviewed doctors Leonard Horowitz and Alan Cantwell in the studio, and the aforementioned Ed Haslam and also Dr. Garth Nicholson joined us via phone hookup. Those are all available from Spitfire. One of the central points of Dr. Horowitz's landmark work, Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, published in hardcover, by the way, by Tetrahedron Incorporated and copyrighted in 1996, one of the central points he makes is that AIDS appears to have grown out of a long project of research, which, among other things, involved the studies of certain diseases affecting people in Africa, and also carefully mapped certain ethno-specific aspects of African peoples, correlating aspects in African populations in the United States. And those programs overlapped with an expressed need on the part of some elements of our national security establishment and political establishment to effect population control in the Third World in general and Africa in particular. Then those very areas that were deemed essential to be subjected to population control were subjected to vaccination programs, and then diseases such as AIDS promptly began breaking out in those very areas. If one feels it's necessary to control population, one wonders why vaccinating a population would be deemed a useful thing to do. That would simply prolong people's lives and maximize their health and add to the population. That's one of the conundrums that Dr. Horowitz takes up, and I think he presents a very compelling argument, though not absolutely airtight, involving scientific and historical and political information, which points to a very, very ominous conclusion about the origin of AIDS. Indeed, in a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing for fiscal year 1969, there was, or actually I think it might have been fiscal year 1970, but at any rate, in 1969, the House Appropriations Subcommittee was debating the military budget, and it was forecast that within 5 to 10 years it would be possible to make a microorganism due to advances in genetic engineering that would be unlike any other. And first of all, that people would not have any natural resistance to it, and second and more importantly, that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we normally depend for our relative freedom from infectious disease. That essentially is the clinical definition of AIDS, and it comes from a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing, and just such a disease appeared within that time frame. There have been a number of, frankly, very lame scientific, or pseudoscientific would be a better way of put it, efforts to date AIDS in the 1940s or 50s or early 60s. This, once people began to point out that this disease appears to have not only arisen out of the clear blue, but arisen in precisely the time period that was forecast in that House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing. And the latest in what I believe is an altogether spurious and frankly lame attempt to prove that AIDS is a naturally occurring disease, and beyond that, one which predates that very sinister discussion in the House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing. By the way, that project was then funded, and just such a disease, AIDS, appeared in precisely the time frame that was forecast in that projection. And bear in mind that that project, a project aimed at producing immune-destroying viruses and microorganisms, did indeed receive funding. Many newspapers carried the following information, or in my opinion, disinformation. The San Jose Mercury News among them, accessing a Los Angeles Times story by Thomas H. Maugh II, M-A-U-G-H, and I may be mispronouncing his name. This is an article, Dateline Chicago, headlined, Origin of HIV Type is Found. The article reads in part as follows. Solving a long puzzling mystery about the origins of the AIDS epidemic, Alabama researchers have shown that the most prevalent form of the AIDS virus, human immunodeficiency virus type 1, almost certainly passed to humans from a common subspecies of chimpanzee. Because the chimpanzee is able to live with the virus without falling ill, the scientists expressed hope that their discovery would eventually help improve therapies and develop an effective vaccine against the AIDS virus. Examining the DNA compositions of HIV-1 and several chimpanzee viruses, Dr. Beatrice H. Hahn, H-A-H-N, and her colleagues at the University of Alabama at Birmingham concluded that the virus passed from chimps to humans three separate times in a small region of West Equatorial Africa some 50 years ago before spreading to what is now estimated to be 35 million human carriers. One of the points of information that's brought out in RFA 16 in an interview with Dr. Wilbert Jordan of Martin Luther King Hospital in Los Angeles is that epidemiology is very carefully monitored, and the health of people in the third world is very carefully monitored and has been for a long time. The notion that a disease as deadly as AIDS could have been prevalent or even present to any significant extent in communities where people's health was already compromised by poor nutrition, other systemic infections, parasites of various kinds, is simply incredible. When the supergonorrhea organism occurred in the Philippines, among other places, every airport in the United States was on alert for that. Similar alerts have been placed and quarantines imposed when just a few cases of outbreaks of highly deadly diseases have been monitored in areas of the third world. And the notion that a disease as deadly as AIDS could have been prevalent in an area like Africa for 50 years or so before it was first detected in gay Americans in three cities, San Francisco, New York, and Los Angeles, and then was detected also in people in rural equatorial Africa, people in Haiti, and the Denali Indians of the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska. Is simply preposterous. That's an epidemiology which makes no sense. Those groups are not having sex. They're not switching blood. They're not sharing needles. The only common denominator is that these groups receive the experimental hepatitis B vaccine and or other vaccines. This is a very complicated argument, and I have not got time to go into all of the aspects of this. Again, I refer interested listeners to RFA 16, which, among other points, brings out the point that some of the monkeys, some of the primates that were used for experimentation in American laboratories connected with biological warfare were eventually returned to the wild in Africa. And so certainly some of the viruses they carried would have been spread to other primates in the wild. And again, the landmark book, Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, and the many broadcasts available from Spitfire will set forth some of these arguments at greater detail and at greater length than I'm in a position to do so right now. Indeed, in the aforementioned book, Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, by Dr. Leonard Horowitz, the point is made that a SIV, a simian immunodeficiency virus that had been detected in macaques, turned out to be identical to HIV-2 or HTLV-4, as it was first called, and that was first detected in prostitutes in Senegal who were not made sick by this particular virus. Indeed, appears, or at least they were not originally detected with AIDS. Indeed, HIV-2 or SIV was first detected in Senegalese prostitutes, and Dr. Horowitz makes the point that that virus almost certainly came from vaccines. Indeed, vaccines are commonly grown on monkey kidneys, and when when the benign strains of the virus to be included in the vaccine are removed from the monkeys, other viruses are routinely removed from the monkeys and frequently contaminate vaccines. In the aforementioned book, Mary Fairy and the Monkey Virus, Ed Haslam makes a very good case that an epidemic of soft tissue cancers currently sweeping the United States had its origin with the contamination of the polio virus with the SV40 or polyoma virus, a virus that produces multiple cancers in multiple creatures, including Homo sapiens. There are a number of half-hour segments excerpting Ed Haslam's book, as well as interviews with Ed Haslam about his particular hypothesis. In the aforementioned Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional, again, authored by Dr. Leonard Horowitz, published in hardcover by Tetrahedron Incorporated, and copyrighted 1996, there's a discussion of the SIV macaque, HIV-2, which turned out to be identical viruses, and some of the precedents to the apparent development of AIDS, and some information that I think should be weighed against the new, quote, arguments, unquote, that are being presented for the African origin of AIDS. Again, that disease, AIDS, was first detected among gays in three North American cities, San Francisco, New York, and Los Angeles, all of which received the experimental hepatitis B vaccine. And the notion that that disease could subsequently be traced back to equatorial Africa is at variance with the basic tenets of epidemiology and is frankly an absurd argument. Of the HIV and SIV discoveries, Dr. Leonard Horowitz writes as follows in Emerging Viruses. And again, I think the recent information, or as I believe, disinformation, should be weighed against the background of the discussion to follow. It is not an easy discussion to follow. That's why I recommend that listeners tape the program. I also recommend that listeners take the next step and get a hold of not only the Emerging Viruses book, but also the numerous tapes that deal with the subject of AIDS as a biological warfare weapon. This section of Leonard Horowitz's book is entitled Max Essex, HIV-2, and the Origin of HIV-1. Perhaps not coincidentally, then, the discovery of monkey AIDS viruses dates back to the earliest days of the recognized human epidemic. According to Laurie Garrett's text, The Coming Plague, in 1969, researchers at the California Primate Research Center in Davis witnessed the first outbreak of AIDS-like symptoms among 42 macaques. The monkeys suffered severe T-cell immune system depression, lymphomas, Kaposi's-like skin patches, and a host of opportunistic infections. Two similar outbreaks occurred in 1976 and 1978 in the same facility. Next, Garrett chronicled another French-American AIDS fracas, this time between Luc Montagnier and Max Essex regarding HIV-2, initially dubbed HTLV-4 by Essex Group and LAV-2 by the French. Essex and colleagues alleged discovering this virus among healthy Senegalese female prostitutes. They reported the women's immune response to HTLV-4 and SIV were equally strong. Essex claimed this find was the, quote, missing link, unquote, to HIV-1, since it was very similar to the monkey virus and humanly benign. Eventually, Gallo published a detailed genetic analysis of SIV macaque and HTLV-4 that indicated that these viruses were identical. Presumably, Gallo's group argued, Essex's laboratory had been contaminated. Monkey and human tissues were somehow mixed. Yet how could SIV macaque and HTLV-4 HIV-2, identical new retroviruses determined to be laboratory contaminants by Schultz, Gallo, and others with roots in the monkey virus kingdom, be infecting Senegalese women and not macaques in the wild? The laboratory was the only common denominator, I realized. For HIV-2 to infect Senegalese women and only humans in the wild, not monkeys, the carriers would have needed to be exposed iatrogenically, that is, by the hand of man. Vaccines were the most plausible way, particularly since SIV-AGM, a documented vaccine contaminant, was also present in these women. Later, during the 1996 National AIDS Update Conference held in San Francisco, I had the opportunity to ask Max Essex during his press conference how, other than through vaccines, could HIV-2, a laboratory monkey virus contaminant not found in monkeys in the wild, have gotten into his Senegalese subjects. After beating around the bush for several minutes, unwilling to answer the question directly, he defended, quote, "I can tell you how my monkeys got infected. Researchers had inoculated the monkeys with human tissues during experiments unrelated to HIV prior to them coming to my lab," unquote. And then Leonard Horowitz goes on to comment, "Though Essex's comment failed to explain just how HIV and HIV-2 got into black Africans and gay Americans in the first place, it did provide an insider's view of human error commonly associated with laboratory contamination, including the threat of viral contaminants being spread from humans to monkeys and back again. Indeed, the laboratory was the only common denominator, I realized, and experimental vaccines were the most likely transmitter." And turning once again to that article from the San Jose Mercury News of Monday, February 1st of 1999, this in turn is an LA Times article. Skipping down, we find something interesting and perhaps significant about one of the monkeys that Dr. Hahn did her research on, one of the chimpanzees. Hahn found the virus twice among living animals that she studied. The third sample came from frozen specimens taken from a 26-year-old chimpanzee named Marilyn. Marilyn died 14 years ago from complications of childbirth at a U.S. Air Force primate center. Federal scientists kept Marilyn's tissues frozen for 10 years to await the day when new and improved tests could more precisely identify the infecting virus. That obviously coming from a laboratory, from a chimpanzee in a U.S. military laboratory. Not conclusive, but interesting and possibly significant. I would note that the information, or as I believe disinformation, about the African origin of HIV-1 was splashed all over the front page of every newspaper that I take, and I take a bunch of them. However, the following article was buried on the back of the classified section of the San Francisco Chronicle. This is from, obviously, the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, February 3rd of 1999. It's an article from Newsday. It's headlined, "Gene Defect in Blacks Raises HIV Risk." Some have six times more chance of infections than whites have, study finds. And it reads in part, "About 20% of blacks carry a genetic mutation that puts them at six times greater risk than whites of being infected with HIV once they're exposed to the AIDS virus," New York scientists announced yesterday. The finding was one of the studies highlighted at the sixth conference on retroviruses and opportunistic infections that experts say should raise new concern about controlling the spread of HIV. Researchers also announced yesterday that they found disturbing levels of drug-resistant viruses being passed from person to person worldwide. The new gene mutation was announced by Dr. Leon Kostrikas and John Moore, the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center in New York City. In an interview, Moore said the defect is related to a cell receptor called CCR5 that's used as an entryway for the human immunodeficiency virus. Although some Caucasians have mutations that protect them from infection by eliminating their CCR5 receptors, the beneficial mutation has not been seen in people of African descent. Sadly, Moore said, the reverse has now been determined. About 20% of African-descended Americans carry the 356T mutation, which somehow, the biological details are yet undetermined, manipulates their CCR5 receptors in a way that makes them highly vulnerable to HIV. The point being that there is a genetic mutation in blacks that makes them more susceptible. There is a genetic mutation in many whites which makes them less susceptible. I am of the opinion that the ethno-specific genetic engineering weapons forecast by the BMA is a reality, or soon will be. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.